Welcome to Quinn's Empowerment Hour on the BBS Radio Network, hosted by Quinn Leigh Erickson, psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. Quinn's experience as a blind woman, a boat person from Vietnam, and a refugee has driven her to realize her dream to help you to become the best that you can be. So join Quinn every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time, for an hour of insight and inspiration for your heart, your spirit, and your soul. Welcome to the first episode of Quinn's Empowerment Hour. This is Quinn Leigh Erickson. I'm a psychotherapist, life coach, and inspirational speaker. So thank you very much for joining me tonight. As this is our first episode together, I will share with you my vision of this show and how that vision has come about, as well as a little bit about my life journey, including my 10 days of being lost in the sea, my journey as a blind person and a boat person from Vietnam. So you have an idea of who I am and why I'm so passionate and excited hosting the Quinn's Empowerment Show. For the last several years, I have been dreaming of hosting a radio talk show that can inspire you, empower you, and in the process, transform your life. I like to create a show where you can be free to be in touch with your heart and be true to yourself. A show that is about empowerment and emotional and social well-being. A show that explores topics that are close to your heart, yet very practical and meaningful in your life. Topics that include marriage, family, relationships, parenting, career, personal success, goal settings, pursuing dreams, independence, self-esteem, self-confidence, mental health issues such as depression and anxiety, sexuality, health and fitness, grief and loss, and disability and illness. And so we'll learn about these topics in the following ways. First, I will share with you my professional experience as a psychotherapist, a coach, a speaker, and now a radio host. I will tell you stories from my personal experience as a woman, a blind woman from a patriarchal and Asian culture, a boat person, and a refugee. And I will also share with you what I've learned from research. But you know, you won't just hear from me. You will also hear from experts in related fields, well-known experts who will share with you their expertise and perspectives in different subjects. But most importantly, this show is for you and about you. And so I heartily invite you to connect with this show, get involved by sharing your stories, asking questions, sharing problems, and making comments and feedback about the show. So during the show, you can call in a toll-free number anywhere in Canada and the U.S., and the number is 1-888-627-6008. 1-888-627-6008. You can also visit my website, which is www.quinnleigh.com. That is www.quinnleigh.com. And so on that page, you can find the Quinn's Empowerment Hour page for the show. So I invite you to get involved because, like I said, this show would not be successful without you. In this show, I like to create a very authentic, respectful, non-judgmental, and heartfelt culture. Because we all come from all walks of life. And yet, at the end of the day, we are all humans. All of us, we struggle in some ways or have problems of some kind. So I might be struggling with vision loss. You might be struggling with things like relationships, grief and loss, or maybe in your career, or you feeling lost in your life, or you not sure where to go next. And yet, every one of us, we all also have gifts, talents, potentials, strengths, skills, and assets. And so, let us come together to support each other. And in the process, we strengthen our hearts and our spirits and bring peace to our souls. And so, in order for me to invite you to connect to this show on a heartfelt level, I need to do that myself first. And so for the remaining time of this show, I will share with you my life story as a blind woman, as a psychotherapist, and as a boat person. Because after all, there are hundreds and even thousands of radio talk shows out there and radio hosts out there. So why would you listen to me or my show, right? So you might ask. And so hopefully after hearing my story, you will have an idea why I'm very passionate hosting a show like this. And so I begin my story with the following quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And he said, "Do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there's no path and leave a trail." And so growing up in Vietnam as a blind woman, the path of my life could have been among the invisible, the voiceless, the oppressed, the disempowered, and the outcast of society. But my parents have refused that path for me. They have refused to accept that path as the path of my life. And so they abandoned that path and started a new pathless path. And so I continued with that pathless path and in the process have found and created my own life path, dedicating my life to empower others as an inspirational speaker and a psychotherapist. So once upon a time, there was a land far, far away. I was born in Vietnam, a communist, poor, impoverished, and war-torn country. Like most babies, I was born with perfect sight, or at least I like to think so, because I can't really remember anything. And I was the second child in the family. When I was 2 years old, for several weeks, I developed a high fever. And so my parents were really worried for me. They took me to the regular family doctor who kept giving me injections and prescribing medications because he couldn't really find anything wrong with me. And so for the next 2 weeks or so, I developed crossed eyes. And my parents at the time, they were quite busy. They had different business ventures, you know, including smuggling goods between cities, and which was considered illegal in Vietnam. And so they often left me at home in the care of a housekeeper. And this is why later on my mom really struggled with a lot of guilt and wondering whether my sight loss was the result of her leaving me at home with a housekeeper. And so one day, my parents came home from a long day after work. And so my mom described this moment to me, a moment which changed my life and their lives forever. She recalled me calling out to her, "Mom, Mom," as I was reaching out my arms, groping my hands around to find her. And that was when she realized that her beloved child could no longer see. And so if you could imagine, my parents were devastated. My mom would cry every day. Although my dad didn't really tell us much about his feelings about the whole situation, my mom would often share with us stories about my childhood. My parents were a young couple. My mom was 23 and my dad was 27. And they came from two large families. My mom had 9 siblings and my dad had 13 siblings. So if you could imagine, their uneducated parents didn't really teach them too much about parenting, let alone parenting a child with special needs. So my parents were pretty much left on their own to figure things out. And so my mom started to have a very bleak vision for my future, and she was really scared because she often saw blind people begging on the street, selling lottery tickets on the street. At the time, blind people could only go to school for the blind for a maximum of 5 years. And even now, you know, people with sight in Vietnam couldn't navigate the street safely, let alone people who could not see. Let me tell you an example of what my life could have been like if I'm still in Vietnam. A few years ago, I visited Vietnam in 2008, and I met up with 7 or 8 of my friends from elementary school when I went to school for the blind for 2 years. And so they were beggars on the street. They sold lottery tickets and earned about a few dollars a day. In the hot sun and the dangerous conditions of Vietnam, I took them to, you know, a relatively nice restaurant and ordered them some seafood. And they told me that they had never been to a nice restaurant, or they'd never tasted nice food like prawns and crabs and mussels. So meeting them made me realize how fortunate I am to live in a country like Canada, how fortunate I am to be able to take advantage of opportunities that come my way. And so for the next several years after my sight loss, my parents were desperate. They would do anything to restore my sight. They would take me to all kinds of temples, doctors, witchcrafts, fortune tellers, so-called healers, anything that they heard about, because they were really desperate. They would follow any practices or feed me any foods that they thought could restore my sight. So for several months, you know, my mom would force me or bribe me to eat turtles because they heard that turtles could help me restore my eyesight. One time, my mom threw a bucket of cold water unexpectedly at me. And so I was shocked and I would scream and I would cry, because she heard that doing something like that could perhaps shock my brain and restore my eyesight. And so seeing me cry, my mom felt so bad for me, and she came and hugged me and cried together with me. So looking back now, my parents realize how naive and desperate they were. So finally, they give up hope in restoring my eyesight in Vietnam. And so they were hopeless. And yet, they never give up on me. Unlike many families in Vietnam, where there was a child with a disability in the family, often that child would be ignored, neglected, or seen as the unwanted, the outcast family member. It was often seen as a shame for a family to have a child with a disability, because in Vietnamese culture or in traditional cultures in general, sometimes there's a thinking that if a person has a disability, That must have meant that their families, or them, must have done something terrible in their previous lives. And so if you could imagine, that kind of approach created little sympathy and compassion for people who are less fortunate. I remember going to a school for the blind and seeing many of my friends being abandoned by their families, and their parents never visited them. And so my parents were determined to take me out of Vietnam, to flee from Vietnam, even though it was considered illegal back then. They wanted to build better lives for us and for me, to find a better future, and they hoped to restore my eyesight. And this was a very difficult decision for my parents, because deep in their hearts they knew it would have been a very risky and dangerous thing to flee from Vietnam. In one of our attempts to flee from Vietnam, we were caught by the government and we were put in prison. So when I was 8, I was actually in prison for 2 weeks. My dad, on the other hand, he was kept in confinement for 3 months. He was kept in a room that was about, I would say, three or four feet by 5 feet big. So he had to eat, sleep, and relieve in that room. And so this event really affected his spirit. I can never forget the image of my dad's arms and hands being tense, being tied at his back by a handcuff. But yet, when I visited him in prison, he always tried to be cheerful and to be affectionate towards me. Finally, when I was 9, in our last attempt to flee from Vietnam, we were successful. And now, I'm going to play for you an audio clip so you have an idea what it was like for Vietnamese boat people trying to flee from Vietnam, what it was like for my family and I for the journey that we were about to embark.
Boat people.
Boat people. This is what the international media has named them. Fleeing their homeland, they are known for their incredible courage in facing tragedies at sea, starvation, drowning, thirst, and the most savage of all, frequent attacks by pirates. Sustained by hope for a new life, the refugees' motto is freedom or death on the high seas. At the hands of the pirates who infest these waters, their lot is more often death. As one refugee put it, when you leave shore, you hope for survival, but you assume that you will die.
At first, it's hard to make out a speck on the horizon. You take a closer look. A boat. A flag, an arm waving. A crowd gathers along the beach. This is the east coast of Malaysia, final destination for thousands of refugees fleeing Vietnam. Many don't make it this far. They're attacked by pirates, drown, or starve to death. These have made it, but will the Malaysian police turn them away? Or will they be stoned by local villagers? The crowd waits to see how many will survive this time. Only a few fishermen help the boat people ashore. We joined in.
Thank you.
far as we could tell, no one drowned coming ashore.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
And just for that, some were grateful.
Thank you, number one. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you. Very, very much, thank you very much.
We had sent distress signs to show that we did not have any food or water. However, they ignored us and acted like they had not seen us. Among us, there was a six-member family who bought food, but finally also died because of thirst. Even healthy youngsters could not survive, and the death toll was about 7 per day. Since then, we were so distressed that we did not send any sign to ships that went by. On our boat, everybody staying in the open air was already dead, except me and another woman.
Before we left, the people of Palau Bidong asked us if they could send a message to the people of the United States.
We, the three members of the Vietnamese Refugee Committee here, on behalf of 23,000 refugees, we would like to give this message. It's only for humanitarian reasons, because we are living in very terrific conditions, and we hope that we will get all the help of the people and the government of the United States. Please help us to survive so that one day we can live in freedom again, as you all. The United States are our only hope.
And now, this was our journey. On a dark, dark night in November 1989, a 30-year-old woman secretively fled from Vietnam with her two young daughters. They traveled on a small converted fishing boat bearing 126 people crammed in like sardines in a can. The boat was so crowded that we couldn't even straighten our legs. By the third day, we ran out of food and water. Our boat, our rickety boat, just drifted endlessly on the Pacific Ocean because the violent storms and waves completely wiped out the engine of the boat. Water kept rushing in, so we were desperate to bail the water out to keep the boat from sinking. Perhaps because of terror and hopelessness, helplessness, hunger and thirst, many of the men on our boat became paralyzed by the threat of the sea. They lied around motionlessly, refusing to help out. And so my mom, along with some other women, decided to take matters into their own hands. And they went around the boat begging for the men to get up to bail the water. They even offered the men any food that we had. And so we saw miles and miles of dark water surrounding us. And we could not see any land in sight. Our lives at the time seemed so small, so invisible, so insignificant compared to the huge and merciless waves of the dark, deep blue sea, waves that were even larger than our lives. And so physically, we were hungry, thirsty, sunburned, seasick, exhausted, and lifeless. Emotionally, we were terrified, hopeless, helpless, and regretful for embarking on this journey. We were half expecting the death was near for us. Around me, I could hear people praying, children crying, people vomiting because of severe seasickness. As a 9-year-old child, I was terrified by the image or the possibility of us drowning in the sea because I couldn't swim, because I knew there were no life jackets on the boat. And so I closed my eyes, imagining that the rocking of the boat was sort of like me rocking on a hammock at home. My heart ached when I thought about the moment of saying goodbye to my dad. When my dad was hugging me, hugging us, knowing that it could have been the last time that he saw his beloved wife and daughters. And so the next time I woke up, I heard a commotion around me. People were shouting excitedly, "There's a ship! There's a ship! We are saved!" And so I heard the ship. The ship was approaching nearer and nearer, and the sound got louder and louder. And so people desperately tried to get attention of the people on the big ship. And so they lit a fire, and actually in the process, almost lit our boat on fire. And so as the ship approached, my mom stood up and looked up. And she was horrified to see what she was seeing in front of her eyes. She saw a very colorful ship. And instinctively, she knew it was those were Thai pirates. Because in her mind, a ship from Westerners would not be that colorful. And so even though she was so sick and so weak, she tried to yell out, "Stay away from those people. Those are Thai pirates." And so another man shouted at her, "Shut up. What do you know as a woman?" And at the time, my mother had to give up, because by that time, the ship was right next to our boat. And so with all her strength, she quickly dragged my sister and I into the hold of the boat, trying to escape from to hide from the pirates. But there was no escape route anyway. And so the pirates started to invade on our boat. With axes in their hands and masks on their faces, they demanded that we give up valuable possessions such as gold. Now, because when people left Vietnam, they often would sell everything that they had, their assets, their properties, everything, their houses. And so they carried with them quite a bit of gold. And so children were crying. People were bowing down their heads to the pirates, pleading them to let us go. Women were screaming in terror because the pirates were sexually assaulting some of them. My mom, desperately trying to protect us in ways that she could, she put a raincoat on my body and told my sister and I to keep quiet and to put our heads down onto our knees to hide from the pirates. My mom then started to vomit on us and on herself, hoping to make our bodies as gross and as undesirable as possible. I was terrified, remembering some of the stories I heard prior to coming onto this boat. Stories of pirates robbing, killing, and drowning Vietnamese boat people. A few feet away, I could hear the voice of a woman crying, "Help me, help me," as the pirates were laughing. And my heart sank when I realized that that was the voice of a friend of our family, known to me as Auntie Flower. And I was very fond of Auntie Flower. But I couldn't understand why no one was trying to help Auntie Flower. No one was trying to say anything to comfort her. And so I was young and I was blind, so I didn't know what was going on. But at that moment, Auntie Flower was raped by three pirates in front of everyone, in front of young children, one by one, as they each of them would hold an axe against her neck. And so I could feel the depth of her pain, even though I didn't know what was going on. And so trying to comfort her, I said, "Please hang in there, Auntie Flower. It will get over soon." But little did I know that such pain would take the rest of her life for her to heal. And so my mom, fearing for our lives and for our safety, she quickly covered my mouth with her hand, telling me to be quiet. And so that event really had a significant impact on my life. I think that was probably when my passion to become a psychotherapist must have started at that time. It also affected my trust in men, consciously or unconsciously. And so for a long time, even though I had men as good friends and good family members, but I could not really trust them with my heart. I couldn't understand how those pirates could have sexual urge at that time. I couldn't understand because we were smelly. After being 7 days on the sea without bathing and lots of vomiting, people were sick and it was overcrowded condition. Later on, as a psychotherapist, I learned that in the cases of rape, sex is not the main issue. The main issue is power and control. Right next to me, there was a 12-year-old girl sitting in the lap of her grandmother. Her grandmother was trying to hold her to protect her. A young pirate was coming towards her, trying to drag her into a dark corner so he could rape her. And so the grandma, desperately, she was pleading with the pirate to let the girl go. She took out a picture of Buddha, hoping that the pirate would be either scared of the Buddha or for whatever reason. So fortunately, he let the girl go. Just as we thought we were on the verge of death, another young woman decided to take a very daring move. She could speak Thai, and so she decided to board the pirate ship, hoping to speak to the captain directly. And deep in her heart, she knew that it was a very risky decision because she could have been raped, killed, captured, and sold for prostitution. But she thought to herself, "I have to enter this dark place in order to save my people." And so I remember her mom was crying to her, please don't go, because you might not be able to return." But miraculously, the young woman got returned to our boat unharmed. And at that time, we heard the announcement over the speaker. Perhaps there was the captain ordering the pirates to leave our boat. And so we were very lucky, because often after the pirates would rob and rape people, they often would crash the boat until it sinks. So our boat continued to drift on the ocean. By the 10th day, my mom was lying, dying on the boat. For several days, she hadn't eaten and she vomited so much that only bile came out of her mouth. She was giving up her food for her daughters and for some of the men, hoping to keep them strong so that they could bear the water. Ironically, my mom is quite sensitive to seasickness. So actually for her to decide to go on a boat journey like this, it was a huge thing for her. So in her tears, my mom quietly said to my sister and I, and she said, "I'm so sorry for risking your lives to come out here. I really thought that it would be the best for you, but it seems that we are losing this battle." And then she turned to my 11-year-old sister and said, "If I go before you, take care of your sister." When my mom decided to flee from Vietnam, she thought that, you know, if we died, we would all die together and she would hold us against her body tight. But now she realized that she might die before her daughters, that she might have to leave her daughters in the sea, the mysterious sea, without any relative, without their father. And so my sister and I pleaded with my mom and said, please, mom, please don't leave us and live for us. So finally, God did listen to our prayers. And so just as we thought we were about to die, a group of German men came and rescued us. So it was the pirates who abused their power and hurt us in the most barbaric ways. And yet, it was the German men who used their power to rescue us and to save our lives. And so I don't think it's that ironic that now I'm married to a German man. And so those German men, they gave us food, they pulled us along our boat alongside the ship, and they took us to a place in Malaysia, a place where another refugee camp for Vietnamese refugee situated. Unfortunately, in 1989, all refugee camps were closed and they no longer admitted Vietnamese refugees to the camp. And so often local authorities would send the boats back into the ocean, knowing full well that eventually those people would die. And so, but we were lucky because those German men, I guess they pressured the Malaysian authorities to keep us. And so, but after the German men left though, the Malaysian government, or the Malaysian soldiers specifically, they started to treat us terribly. They took us deep, deep into the woods, ordered us to cut down trees and to set up tents so we could sleep there and stay there. And so, you know, after being 10 days in the sea, the men were traumatized and hungry and exhausted. So some of them were slow to obey the soldiers' orders. So those soldiers, they would use their military boots, heavy boots, and kick at the men violently. And so we stayed there for 30 days in the woods, sleeping in the tents with tree roots underneath our bodies. And so when it rained, the tents would soak, and when it was hot, oh boy, it was hot. Malaysian heat can be extremely hot. And at night, it can get chilly too, because we didn't have blankets and pillows to sleep on. But you know, I also experienced something quite curious during those 30 days. Those Malaysian soldiers, even though they could be mean, aggressive, and violent, somehow they were quite nice to me, as a 9-year-old blind child. They discovered that they could sing in broken English. So every day they would come and they told me to sing for them. And so after I finished singing, they would give me eggs and other goodies and food. And so eventually I had so much eggs and foods that I would share with other children. And I remember one time I had some mosquito bites on my legs and my body. And so those soldiers, they would give me incense and lotion to help sort of deal with those mosquitoes. And even some of them, they applied the lotion in a very gentle way on my body, in a very gentle and just very caring way, a way that they would treat a helpless child. And so I think that's when I realized unconsciously that people, you know, doesn't matter how bad they are, how mean they are, but deep, deep down, there's always a spot somewhere in the heart, a spot for compassion, softness, and empathy. And so finally, they took us to another refugee camp in Indonesia. And so I was on an island called Galang Island in Indonesia. And that island had more than 20,000 Vietnamese refugees. And I was just a number among thousands of those refugees on a small and overcrowded island. Each of us, we would receive about 3 cans of sardine per month. So next time when you go groceries, look at how big a can of sardine is. And so imagine for each of us, we were allowed 3 of those cans per month and 4 cups of rice a week. So living there, I really understood what it was like to be hungry, what it was like to wake up every morning and not knowing what to eat on that day. We lived in barracks that were made out of woods and tin metal roofs. So those tin metal roofs during the day, the heat can be extremely hot. And when it rained, it was really loud that sometimes I couldn't even hear people talking. Our sleeping area was, each of us was about 1 foot by 6 feet long. And so if you could imagine this, the image of dozens and dozens of people lying beside each other on a raised wooden platform that ran from one end of the barrack to another. So this long, long wooden platform. Sometimes we were even, 5 of us were forced to fit in a room of about 4 feet by 6 feet big. So barely would fit 2 small beds for 5 people. So living there, you know, we had little privacy. And the only time we had privacy was when we had to relieve in one of those camp outhouses. But what was the hardest for us was a sense of hopelessness, helplessness, a lack of control in our lives, a sense of uncertainty, a lack of self-respect and self-dignity. There was nothing for me to do as a blind person. I couldn't go out to play like other kids. I couldn't go to classes to learn, to study like other people. And so often my mom would teach me English or whatever English she knew, which wasn't a lot. And every day, I would spend most of my day rocking on a hammock at home. And I was a very quiet and shy child then. Even though often we were hopeless, but I didn't remember being depressed. I guess I just accepted circumstances for what they were. And, you know, I also saw some of the worst things about people. You know, some people stole, they fought for food, they were mean to each other, they were nitpicking because basically we lived next to each other every day. And yet, like always, there are always 2 sides to each story. There were also countless stories of compassion and kindness among people. Those kind acts really made our days bearable. There was a woman who would sell popsicles on the street in the afternoon, and every day she would drop by to give me a popsicle. So every afternoon when it was extremely hot, I was really looking forward to getting her popsicle, to feel her kindness. And those popsicles, they tasted delicious when it was really hot. Another neighbor would borrow a typewriter for me to learn to type without being able to see. So my family and other people would teach me so each key on the typewriter. And that's how I learned to type. For a few months, a man would come and teach me to play guitar. Or another woman would lend me a Walkman. And you know, that was in the early 1990s, because we lived there from 1989 to 1994. And so Walkman was a really rare thing. But she would lend me a Walkman so I could listen to music. And every few days she would come and charge it up for me, because there was no electricity and I didn't have batteries. And people would play cards with me. They would play Scrabble with me. And so those things really made our days. And yet, some people, they had the power to transform our lives. One day, my mom and I, we were walking home in the blazing heat of Indonesia in the afternoon. We were feeling very hopeless because on that day we learned that our refugee claim was rejected and denied. So that meant that eventually we would be sent back to Vietnam, even though we risked our lives to cross the ocean. And so if you could imagine, we were extremely hopeless. And then I started to have a heat stroke. So panicky, my mom waved at a car that was driving by. And you know, typically, we wouldn't hitchhike in the refugee camp because those cars often belonged to important officials. And so at first, the car would drive on. And we were disappointed, but we weren't surprised. And then yet, a few minutes later, the car turned back and stopped in front of us. And so excitedly, we got into the car. And because I've never been in the car before, I actually bumped my head onto the door of the car. And then when my mom settled down, she realized that one of the men in the car was the head of the United Nations refugee panel. He was responsible for making decisions regarding Vietnamese refugee claims. So my mom excitedly whispered to me this realization. And at the time, you know, I was an 11-year-old child, but somehow I instinctively decided to seize this golden opportunity. So with much nervousness and in my broken English, of course, I said to the man, "I am blind, blee, help me." And so at that moment, somehow, I was able to touch that man's heart. And so the next day, he called us up and he overturned the decision. That's how I could be here today. Because without him, my family may have been in Vietnam at this time. And this was a miracle because that never happened before. And so my case actually set precedents for many other cases. People with disabilities or people who were blind would come to him and ask him to help them. And so, you know, when you listen to Syrian refugees now, it can be easy to see them as another drama, or see them as numbers, or some kind of annoyance, or just another story. And so I invite you to open your heart to see that those people are suffering every day. Those people, their lives are just as worthwhile as yours and mine. And so to conclude my talk today, I want to remind you that we are not determined by what happened in our lives, but we are determined by how we make of what happened in our lives. So even though I came from a very poor country, fled that country, traveled by boat to come here to become a psychotherapist, but I changed my life by making the best of my life, making the best of what I can have. And so I really hope you can make the best of what you still have. And so thank you very much for joining me tonight, the Quinn's Empowerment Hour show. Next two Saturdays, so two Saturdays from now, I will join you again. And I will invite an expert who will share with you his perspective and expertise about men dealing with anger and with conflicts. Because I really want this show to be for different types of people, for men, for women, and for people with different issues. So 2 Saturdays from now, join me and learn more about anger and conflicts in men, and what are some of the things men can do to help them cope with anger and to help them make the best of their anger. And so for more information about me, about Quinn, please visit my website at www.quinnle.com. So that is www.quinnle.com. So I hope you will have a beautiful, restful sleep, and I will see you again in 2 Saturdays. Good night. This is Quinn's Empowerment Hour, hosted by Quinn Le Erickson, every other Saturday, 9 p.m. Pacific Time. For more information about Quinn, visit www.quinnle.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a beautiful, restful sleep. Good night.